live through the theology of the body.
Tune in for great advice, guests, and the information you need to take your marriage, family, and personal life to the next level.
Weekdays at noon on Ave Maria Radio.
This is full-time Catholic radio for Southeast Michigan, 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
I've got Frank Buckley on the show today. He is a foundation professor at George Mason School of Law. He's been on the show before. We had him on not too long ago to discuss his wonderful new book, From Encounter, The Way Back, Restoring the Promise of America, where we discussed what was surprising to many people given Frank's reputation as a leading conservative thinker, and that is the wealth inequality in America and the impact that has had on our, very terrible impact it's had on our culture and our nation's promise. And I've asked him to come on today to talk about, he's written a series of articles in various places, the most recent in USA Today, trying to explain to the public the Donald Trump phenomenon. And the reason I want him to get on is because we're hearing, all we hear day by day about Donald Trump is of the ad hominem variety, and within this big pile of ad hominem attacks, I believe, and I'm sure, and I think Frank does, that the true significance of this, and perhaps with the Bernie Sanders phenomenon too, there's a genuine American rebellion, for lack of a better term, brewing. You describe this, Frank, in your latest column, which I said from USA Today, but you've been doing it in a series of columns, which I've seen. So, Frank Buckley, welcome to Church and Culture, and tell us about this rebellion we're watching.
Well, Deal, thank you so much for having me. It's great to be on. It's indeed, I think, a rebellion, and it bears comparison with what happened in 1776, on my view. The revolution was a rebellion against a number of things, but money wasn't exactly a big deal. The amount of the tax was peanuts, roughly. And, you know, both England and America are free, but England was an extremely corrupt country at that time. And what the framers thought was, the corruption they saw in England was endemic to monarchies. They wanted a republic, which they thought might be pure and virtuous as compared to a corrupt England. And in part that stemmed, I mean, there are a number of things that are going on, but you know, one of them was the religious divines, mostly Protestant, taking their texts from the Bible about corrupt kings. And also people at the time were reading the classical Roman authors, and a very famous historian, J.G.A. Pocock, said what happened in 1776 was what he called the Machiavellian moment. And what he meant by that was Machiavelli, in 250 years earlier, had looked at the same writers, Livy, and described how they had, the ancient Romans had expelled the kings of Rome, and held up an idea of republican virtue. Okay, and we're seeing the same kind of thing going on right now. I mean, Pocock said 1776 was a Machiavellian moment. What I'm looking out at as I look out my window today is another Machiavellian moment where people have just had it up to here with all the corruption, all the crony capitalism, all the ways in which laws are perverted by a group of insiders. And it's indeed it has gotten worse, far worse. So, you know,
is this why K Street is more afraid of Trump than they are of Hillary Clinton?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, with Hillary Clinton, they know what they've got. It's business as usual. I mean, what Clinton represents is Clinton cash, basically a way in which her family was made immensely wealthy by, it seems, selling U.S. foreign policy for contributions to Bill's charity. But also somebody who's comfortable with the way things are, right? I mean, she's going to talk a lot about protest and all of that, but it's pretty much steady as she goes, whereas Trump represents somebody who wants to break it. who wants to take a sledgehammer to it. And that's his appeal. And as well, that's also why he's frightening to a lot of people. And that's not a right-left thing, right? Because one of the big forces on the right would be the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Well, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is basically a symptom of what's going on with the way in which they're permitted to shape legislation, and of course all the K Street lobbyists. So what you end up with, for example, is a 1,000-page Obamacare bill, which is jam-packed with goodies for this state or the other state, followed by 20,000 pages of regulations. And they said you have to pass the bill to know what's in it. God knows what's in those regulations, except we can pretty much assume that there's a lot of cronyism going on. And you know something? That's a lot like the way Britain and all the courtiers surrounding the throne in Britain looked like to the patriots in 1776. We've got our same revulsion of what's going on. And it's not really a left-right phenomenon. It's a different axis entirely. It's a virtue corruption axis.
Now, a lot of people listening, or some might kind of smile with the idea of connecting the issue of virtue with the Trump candidacy.
Yeah, I guess so. My answer to that is good old Joe Kennedy, JFK's father. Joe Kennedy was appointed to head up the Securities and Exchange Commission by FDR in 1935, and people said, wait a minute, Joe Kennedy, it doesn't get much dirtier than that, and FDR's answer was, it takes one to catch one.
So that's the truth.
See, we all know Trump has played the game. I mean, he boasted that he had the Clintons at his daughter's wedding. Why? Because he contributed to their charities. That's how the game works. But he certainly was the only guy on the Republican side who talked about this as being a real problem, right? I mean, he's talking about trying to cure some of the problems with some form of campaign finance reform. No other Republican would touch that with a 10-foot barge pole, right? So,
because they don't want to lose the support of all the PACs that are giving them the money to run for office.
Yeah. So
really the story here is not who Trump is so much as where the American people are. And this reflects both in the direction of Trump and of Bernie Sanders. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely.
And so if
Trump will make a play for Sanders voters.
You think you'll be successful?
I think there are a lot of Trump supporters who would never vote for Hillary. And some of them will vote for Trump. Yeah, I think so.
So if we
depends
put
how the game is played, I mean, it, you know.
So you're putting the spotlight.
The reach out is, yeah.
Frank, you're putting the spotlight on the dynamics in our nation, in our culture, that are making it possible for Donald Trump or Bernie Sanders to become major players in American politics, and Donald Trump may become president of the United States, for all we know. You've taken the focus off of Donald Trump's, how do you want to put it, his character, or his lack of it, or his business dealings, or his loose tongue, or however you want to lash him. And by the way, I would like for you to address this. My 19-year-old son came home from high school. He's going to graduate in a few weeks. But what he told me is that he has heard from numerous students and even from one teacher that if Donald Trump is elected, he'll cause World War III. Now,
well,
I remember what LBJ did to Barry Goldwater, but
yeah.
What's going on to create that kind of buzz?
Well, Trump fosters that by his loose tongue. And I have to say that while I support Trump, nevertheless, he has this amazing ability to shock his supporters on occasion. I realize it works. It worked in the primaries. I don't think it's, I think it's time to stop it right now, pretty sharp. As for, you know, and so I can see how people looking at that kind of personality would say, well, you know, he's kind of.
And that's being said overseas, as you well know. It's being said overseas quite a bit.
Yeah. But you know, the fact is, you know, he is far less likely to get America involved in the foreign war than is Hillary Clinton. I mean, Hillary's record is replete with failed foreign interventions, whereas Donald's campaign, his foreign policy campaign, is roughly bring America home. You know, let's not get involved in anything over there, which is not in America's interest, right? So, I mean, so that implies a very different kind of foreign policy from what we've seen for the last 20 years. I mean, Trump has specifically criticized George W. Bush's foreign policy as being really too naive in terms of nation building. And so I think it would be a rather more peaceful world. I also think that he'd be in a good position to reach out to trouble spots like Russia and even perhaps China, in the sense that any fear of American, rambunctious foreign policy of the kind associated with both Hillary and George Bush wouldn't happen on a Trump watch. We'd have a far more specific kind of foreign policy. But I don't buy that. That's just silly. I there are things about Trump that I don't care for much. I mean, beating up on federal judges, I think it's just silly. But in other respects, he's basically a centrist. For example, I mean, on health care, for example, he wouldn't be a purist, as Republicans tend to be, about some form of national health. He said, I don't want to see people dying on the streets. Well, you know, guess what? Neither do most Americans. And so he represents, I think, a really benign change from a kind of right-wing orthodoxy where you're given a list of 97 different right-wing ideas and you're supposed to check them off. That kind of describes the Cruz campaign, doesn't it? I mean, it was like he had this checklist and he had to list everything on it, whereas, you know, Trump, they say he wasn't a real conservative. In some respects, he was middle of the road on a whole bunch of issues, which is roughly where the American people are.
But they're not middle of the road on the issue of wanting fundamental change in regard to the spoils system. But tell our listeners, you make the comment in your USA Today column that it was Andrew Jackson who set up the spoils system. Can you explain that to us?
Yeah, well, the framers themselves were wonderful people, the people who gave us our Constitution and their convention in Philadelphia in 1787. They were, you know, just splendid people. The theorists didn't dominate. The practical people did, and they got the deal done. And their sense of Republican virtue lasted for a period of time. What did Republican virtue mean? Well, it wasn't democratic to start with, right? I mean, they had an idea of a quasi aristocracy, not a birth, but a virtue that would dominate American politics. And of course, Andrew Jackson swept that aside. He complained about a corrupt bargain between John Quincy Adams and Henry Clay, but in fact, it was Jackson, that fantastic brawler, that fighter of Indian Wars, who first of all made money in terms of excluding Indians from their land and thought duels and introduced the spoil system. And, you know, it's sort of funny to read Democratic champions describing Jackson. Arthur M. Schlesinger Jr. wrote a book called The Age of Jackson, in which he celebrated the spoil system. He said, well, this was basically just democratic. I mean, it gave jobs to people who'd been excluded by all these guys from Harvard and Yale. Well, okay, but I'm, you know, that the Dems were a party comfortable with a degree of corruption. The Republicans were the party of opposed to Tammany Hall, and these were the goo-goo people. Sometimes there was a tinge of racism there. But nevertheless, the Republican Party at its core was an anti-corruption party, but now it's become comfortable with it.
And basically the spoils system is, if you support me along the way when I'm elected, you will get yours.
Pretty much, yeah. And everybody played it in the 19th century. I mean, you know, Abraham Lincoln would be distracted from planning a civil war by trying to determine who was going to get the post office in Cairo, Illinois. It was the way the game was played. Civil service reform in the 1880s tended to bring an end to that, but of course it's certainly alive and well in Washington. Gosh, there are so many people who are dependent upon their side being in power.
You don't hear the word corruption per se. Is this a word that Donald Trump uses?
He hasn't really used it. He's talked about crony capitalism. He's talked about cronies. He's talked about campaign finance reform. He is certainly, as a compared to Hillary, the anti-corruption candidate. I mean, Hillary, read Peter Schweitzer's book, Clinton Cash. Hillary fairly reeks of it. She's been entirely comfortable with it, which tends to help explain her popularity, certainly from all the people who are going to be, the winners from the new spoils system.
How much of the rebellion is about the same thing that propelled Andrew Jackson into office? This sense of, you know, this entitled insider group, and that a great part of the American people simply have no say, no genuine say in how laws are made.
Well, I think there's a lot of truth in that. I mean, it was a Western rebellion in many respects. That simplifies greatly. I mean, Henry Clay, for example, was from the West as well. There was certainly a strong element of class conflict in the election of 1828 and the rise of democracy at that particular period. I mean, one thing that was happening at that time is the states were amending their constitutions to permit everyone, by which I mean all white males, to vote. And that was transforming politics in America. It was a worldwide phenomenon. I mean, if we talk about it here, we'll talk about 1828. If you talk about it in Britain, you'll talk about 1832 and the Great Reform Act. It happened around the same time in Canada. Everybody goes through these things at about the same time. But there's one big difference between America now and other countries, and that is that we have this greatest concentration of influence and patronage of any country at any time in world history, across the river for me in Washington, D.C. There's nothing comparable in other countries, in Germany or France or England. They have their insiders, but they don't have anything as vast as what we have here. And I guess people sense that. And we're told, get used to it, get comfortable with it, and people aren't comfortable with it anymore. At the same time, they've realized that there's an economic malaise of a different order from anything we've seen before. This is the first time when people say, in response to pollsters, we don't think our children will do as well as we did, and that's
right.
New, and it's never happened before. I mean, just by way of a sense of history, my teacher was Raymond Klebanski, the philosopher, and his mentor was Friedrich Tonnies, the mineshaft guy, and his financial supporter was Friedrich Engels. So only three generations separate your listeners from the Communist Manifesto. And Marx had this great problem with America. It didn't fit his theory of history. His theory of history is you progress from an agrarian feudal society to capitalism to communism. And in the 1850s, the big capitalist society was America, and America was not going communist. So Marx said, I've got a problem. And this, his explanation was, Well, America is a very mobile country. There are no rigid classes, so it's sort of an exception to my historical pattern. But what happens when you get a class system emerging, as we have in this country, when the classes are ossified? Well, what happens then is you get a Bernie Sanders or maybe, you know, a Donald Trump. You get a revolution from below.
It seems, though, that the Trump phenomenon was initially fueled by his position on immigration.
Yeah. And
how is that tied into what your basic thesis is here?
Well, a bit of background. Firstly, the Democrats seized upon immigration as a human rights issue, and the Republicans had no real connection with the American people, at least with Americans, citizens, so as to oppose that. They didn't have the language, they didn't have the temperament, they didn't have the feeling, they didn't have the compassion, right? So Democrats said, you know, if you are devoid of compassion, why then you'll oppose open borders, but if you're a compassionate person, you'll like open borders. And Trump's challenge is no. You know, compassion begins at home, and if you support open borders, what you're demonstrating is your lack of compassion for the American people. And you know, what was behind this was a Republican class, a thinking class, that was, you know, averse to the idea of nationalism and unconnected to Americans generally. I mean, they hang out in their think tanks and whatnot. You know, they might be a member of the ABEI. You know what the ABEI is? It's called the Arthur Brooks Enterprise Institute.
Oh, yeah, I know.
So, you know, their motto is, I'm all right, Jack, or else I've got mine. And between them and NASCAR Nation and big truck rallies, the deepest of all chasms has opened up.
That's for sure.
They have nothing to do with that other nation out there. So we've become two nations, you know, this small, minuscule nation that takes people like David French seriously. And
I had never heard of him until he was brought up by Bill Kristol. Was I supposed to have heard of him?
Well, I'd heard of him. I'd had an unpleasant encounter with him in the past and decided he wasn't a very nice fellow. But the fact that a complete nobody was taken seriously just tells you how certainly politically bankrupt, you know, this intellectual establishment is. Like, they have no clue whatsoever. I'm picking up an absolute nobody, indeed a person deservedly a nobody. And holding them up as
tell us what you really think. Right?
I've met the guy. Yeah. So without getting into details, the sheer ridiculousness of the whole episode is worthy of a Tom Wolfe. I mean, it's, you know, a wonderful comic novel could be written about all of this, and it wouldn't be believable but for the fact that this actually happened. You know, we were talking about immigration, and the point I wanted to make is that it is almost de rigueur in conservative intellectual circles to believe in open borders, right? You know, the implication is, nationalism is per se bad. And the Trump revolution is in part a revolution around the idea of nationalism. And I like the idea of nationalism. Right? I mean, you know, you can't start talking about it, you know, with anybody before they start talking about fascism, which simply is nuts. My answer is that, you know, I may not be the greatest fan of, say, Serbian nationalism or German nationalism, but American nationalism is essentially benign because it's rooted in core liberal documents like the Declaration or the Constitution. And if you stray from those documents, why then, you know, you're betraying the idea of American nationalism. So there are self-correcting tendencies in American nationalism. Beyond all that, if you don't have a special feeling for Americans as opposed to non-Americans, then you're simply absolutely devoid of compassion, right? A person who says, I am indifferent as between non-Americans, illegal aliens, and Americans, doesn't care about either. That's what he's really saying.
Well, I think there is that there is a sense in the air that, frankly, was articulated by Pope Francis himself, that walls are not the way to solve the problem.
There is that. I think that, you know, if one has sat through a good many sermons, there are times when one rather tunes out the message a little bit. There are no walls in the sense that we all have souls, and religion, Catholicism specifically, certainly knows no boundaries. But it is the case that we are entitled to prefer Americans to non-Americans when it comes to our borders, and that we fail to show proper compassion if we don't do so. I mean, I'll give
Well, the first duty of any political leader is to protect the lives and well-being of its citizens.
Absolutely. You know, that's why people go to war, and that's why countries enlist to fight in war. And they don't do that if borders don't matter, right? I mean, World War II, and we celebrated the anniversary of D-Day yesterday. World War II was a crusade led by several countries, notably the United States, against great evil. That would not have been a crusade that would have been possible, led by an open borders kind of fellow.
We're going to take a short break. We're talking to Frank Buttley, who is a professor of law at Georgia Mason University Law School. His most recent book, which we're going to talk a little bit after the break, The Way Back, Restoring the Promise of America and the Trump Candidacy. We'll be right back after this short break.
The following is a message brought to you by the Catholic Biblical School of Michigan. One of the greatest gifts God has given to us is wisdom. According to the Catechism, wisdom is a spiritual gift which enables one to know the purpose and the plan of God. So how do we obtain this wisdom for our lives? In a dozen places, the Old Testament tells us, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Fear of the Lord means being humble before God. St. James tells us that we can likewise approach God in humbleness seeking wisdom. He wrote, if any of you lack wisdom, let him ask God. Let us pray that when we do not know the right direction to go or the course of action to take, we will humble ourselves and trust that God will give us the wisdom we need for the situation at hand. This message is brought to you by the Catholic Biblical School of Michigan. You can find us on Facebook or at cbsmich.org.
Light of the East. Weekends on Ave Maria Radio.
I'm Father Thomas Loya. This week on Ave Maria, our efforts at unity extend even to non-Christians such as the followers of Islam. Dialogue in this area could be significantly determined by a single ancient building in the country of Turkey.
Saturday evenings at 8:30 and Sunday mornings at 9 on 990 WDEO Ave Maria Radio.
Hi, I'm Bishop Earl Boyer of the Diocese of Lansing, and I want to invite you to join Steve Ray, Al Cresta, and Father Steve Mattson on a pilgrimage and seminar at sea entitled Building the Household of Faith in the Footprints of St. Paul. It's a seven-night journey with stops and teachings in the Temple of Apollo, Philippi, Patmos, and many more. There will be daily Mass at biblical sites. Come walk with them in the footsteps of St. Paul.
I'm back with Professor Frank Buttley of the George Mason School of Law. We're talking about the Trump candidacy, but I want to ask Frank to tie it into his book, which was published just a few months ago, The Way Back, Restoring the Promise of America. In that book, as I said in the first half hour, you're a well-known conservative professor of law, but also you do history and philosophy. You talk at length about the damage being done to our country by the inequality of wealth and the way in which the promise of America, you know, upward mobility and so forth, has really become severely damaged and, if not put to death for the time being, by the vast inequalities of wealth and lack of mobility, you know, up and down the scale. Is there some connection of that to this, these waves of support for, you know, Trump and even Sanders?
Absolutely. And I think it also helps to explain the schism in the Republican Party. The group, the party that has raised inequality as a problem is, of course, the Democrats. And they got a fresh wind when a fellow called Thomas Piketty wrote a book on capital in the 21st century, where he described his vision of permanent class distinctions. And factually, you know, Piketty did not understand America at all. And, you know, factually, his analysis is, just doesn't hold water, at least as far as this country is concerned, and I think generally. But nevertheless, I mean, the issue got a breath of fresh air. And, you know, the Republican response was roughly, well, to the Democrats was roughly, well, if you're for it, I'm against it.
Right.
So, if they wanted to talk about it, the Republican Party was bound to say, well, it's just, you know, just envy and socialism and all that old stuff. And that missed the point that there's a big distinction between inequality and immobility, right? So, you know, we all, you know, would like to be better off. We'd like to be better off relative to other people, but we're more concerned about our kids. Right. So if we find out, and it's the case, that we're a very immobile country, the idea is, well, where we are is roughly where our kids will be. And that is, in fact, the case. So, you know, in my book, I looked at the top and bottom 10% in the United States and compared it to Canada, which is, you know, a very similar country. And if you're in the top 10% in the States, your kids have a 50% chance of being in the top 10 or 20%. And if you're in the bottom 10%, your kids have a 50% chance of being at the bottom 10 or 20%. By comparison, Canada's a land of opportunity, right? There's nothing like that. And that's what's distressing, the idea that social classes are fixed. Now, that's something that the Republicans should have picked up on. They should have said, we don't all end up in the same place because we're divided in terms of skills and energy and effort and all that, but we'd like our kids to have an equal chance. And the Republicans basically muffed it, and the perfect Republican idiot said, oh, well, I'm not even sure if there's all that much of a problem about immobility. Well, there is. Or he said, well, if it's there, it's all a matter of envy, and you know, therefore I'm not going to pay attention to it.
Somebody should have slapped him at that very moment.
Say again?
Somebody should have slapped him at that very moment.
I know. It's, you know, envy's a...
Nothing like losing, you know, yeah. 70% of America on a comment like that.
Yeah, I know. Envy is by definition a sin, but comparing yourself with other people and wanting to, you know, work your way up is virtuous.
And that's not envy. Envy is comparing yourself to other people and wanting what they have from them, taking what they've got.
Yeah. Well, or, you know, looking at what other people have and saying, well, I'm going to work harder to get there. That's a definite.
That's not envy.
Yeah, that's not envy. I mean, Aquinas is smart enough to figure that out, and so should the Republicans, but, you know,
Wait a minute. I don't know. I don't know if that fits. Just because Aquinas is smart enough, I'm not sure the Republicans or the Democrats.
I guess. Cretinism does not descend lower than Republican intellectuals.
Now,
but the other thing
has Trump addressed this?
Has Trump
onto this?
He is, although he could make it stronger. He's going to give a economic speech sometime in the near future, before the convention. So we'll wait and see. And I know that he is smart enough to realize that this has not got to be a matter of Mitt Romney's 59 points and here's what I'll do with this little tax wrinkle. It's more a question of, you know, how do we get Americans mobile again? So I think that it's on the cards that he's going to be talking about it.
Which means that he's learning to thematize the concerns of the people who are so avidly supporting him.
Right, and that's a winning ticket, I think, in terms of the election. I mean, if he wants to win the election, there are a few things he's got to do, like maybe not lip off quite as much as he has in some respects, but assembling a coalition of people who think that there is something we can do about income and mobility, and there is something we can do about corruption is a winning ticket, I think. And in terms of immobility, the reason why it's specifically a winning ticket for somebody like Trump is because all of the barriers to mobility are barriers that the left has erected. So you think about it, and what you have are, you know, really bad K-12 schools in this country as compared to other countries.
Horrible.
You had me on before, and I described how I went to a public school in Canada where all the teachers were nuns, and some people thought that shocking, but the town was entirely French Canadian. So,
why not?
Yeah, a very Protestant government in my province thought, well, exactly, why not? You know, nobody's much complaining, and they're all, you know, everybody's getting a good modern liberal education. But, you know, the most important thing was, apart from the values that were really communicated, the most important thing was you ended up with a sense of competition. If you have a voucher system and you have competing educational systems along any lines you want, I mean, denominational or whatever, the competition is going to make everybody better off. But we don't have that. We have instead a Stalinist system, and it's every other country in the world that has the kind of competition I described. So, you know, the really ironic thing is when you go back to the First Amendment and you look at the difference between non-establishment and free exercise, countries that have an established church in some respects have more religious liberty than we do, because if they have an established church, they're used to the idea that, you know, you can have confessional K-12 systems, and that's okay. So, you know, you can go to what is an officially Protestant state, and you'll find that there are Catholic schools that are state-supported. There is your competition.
That's very ironic.
If we're measuring
Trump against your book, then I have to ask you, where is he on education?
On education?
Yes.
He hasn't spoken about that. It's a state issue, right? It's not a federal issue. The Supreme Court has blessed vouchers. The Supreme Court has said it is okay to have vouchers that, you know, where parents can take them anywhere they want, including parochial schools, provided that there is a local public school you can go to, which covers, you know, pretty much the whole country. But the barriers come at the state level. So I haven't heard him speak about that, but it's a state issue, essentially.
I know that he's criticized Common Core.
Yeah, he does want the feds to get out of it. He says he would abolish the Department of Education. I mean, I have my own idea for the Department of Education. What I would do is I would take the $63 billion they have and block grant it, just give it to the states to spend on vouchers. And then what I do with the Department of Education building is I blow it up and I turn it into a hotel. Right? And there'd be...
Well, then why blow it up if you want to turn it into a hotel? Why not just turn it into a hotel?
Because it's one of those horrible 1970s buildings in downtown Washington. It's so faceless. You've driven by it 100 times.
Oh, yeah, I've been in it.
Okay, well, I don't think I'm
I once upon a time made a journey to the Department of Education to ask for some help on liberal education and realized very quickly I had come to the wrong building.
Yeah, dynamite. That's the thing, you know, dynamite. But when I say that the problems come from the left, the barriers to school competition are always from the Democratic Party. The barriers to a decent immigration system are always from the Democratic Party. I mean, plus some libertarians and open border types in this country. But, let me put it this way. Immigration is a huge issue in this country, which, thanks to Trump, Australia's 25% foreign-born, Canada's 20%, we're 14-15%. This is not an issue. Immigration is not a political issue in those countries, Australia and Canada, because they have a pro-nativist policy. In other words, they'll take in immigrants, but only if they're going to add to the wealth of the country, right? And this is good on so many levels. I mean, if it's helping natives, it helps native-born citizens. But I make a further argument that personal virtue correlates with economic success. That if you pick people on the basis of, are you going to be good for the economy, you're also picking people who on average will be more virtuous than other people. Whereas we have the craziest immigration system in the world. Everyone thinks it's a joke.
There's also the related issue of national security with what is effectively de facto an open border. And just the other day there was a story about Afghan terrorists who came over the border. Half of them were caught, but the other half were not. And it seems as if the border guards in Texas and New Mexico have been completely stripped of any authority to actually make arrests and send people back. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. And that helps to explain, I guess, the sense of frustration most Americans feel and their willingness to support Donald Trump. We're describing a country where you have most Americans have no trust in the government of this country to protect them, to take care of them. I mean, in so many ways, they've gotten a message that, you people who cling to your guns and your religion, we're not terribly concerned about you, which, by the way, is the same message that's come out of the intellectual, so-called intellectual right, the National Reviews of the world. I mean, their message is, oh, well, you know, the guys who are supporting Trump just are, you know, are people who are snorting cocaine, OxyContin, and going to die out. You know, like I say, you know, it's only from that kind of a milieu that a joke like David French would be taken seriously.
It seems to me that, like as you described before the break, the conservative / Republican intellectuals in this country, most of them D.C. or New York based, are so out of touch that the Trump phenomenon exposes how out of touch they are, and very few of them, if any of them, I can't think off my top of my head who's it. Well, one prominent one has admitted, David Brooks, of being out of touch with sort of mid-America.
Mm-hmm.
But I think part of their obstinacy is that they don't want to admit that their ignorance has been revealed.
Well, there are a couple of things. That's one of them. Yeats talked about what happens when the falcon cannot hear the falconer. The falconer is the intellectual crowd that thinks it's running the show. The falconer is Donald Trump. Yeats thought mere anarchy would be loosed in the world when that happened. And that's, I guess, what the intellectual right has been saying about all of this. But there's something deeper than even what you've mentioned, and that is I suspect that some of this crowd recognizes that Trump is an authentic American in the way that Muhammad Ali was an authentic American, and that what's bothering them is their instinctive anti-Americanism, right? We're talking about a people who have not merely isolated themselves in their own little intellectual bubbles, their own little magazines, their own little think tanks, but in so doing, they felt that they're superior to the rest of the NASCAR Americans, the guys who turn on hockey, whatever it might be, regular Americans. And to be reminded of someone so obviously not of their class as being a popular candidate must shock them, right? It's the rage of Caliban looking at his face in the mirror. Oh, my God, these are Americans just like me. I hate it, right? They've always imagined that they belong to this pure little country, which, it's a mid-Atlantic country where they talk like Katharine Hepburn in the Philadelphia Story, and they say my was a DR, and, the country is south of Iceland and east of the New Yorker, and meanwhile they're discovering, my God, there's something place called Iowa here. Right.
What do you make of the resistance among evangelical leaders to Donald Trump? Now, I know that has broken down a great deal, as has some of the Republican leadership. But there was a lot said, very negative, about Donald Trump by a lot of the self-appointed leaders of the Christian right. What do you make of that?
Well, if you're an evangelical and you take a look at Trump's family values, you can see a guy who's been divorced a couple of times. Mind you, he's a great family man. I mean, he gets along wonderfully with all his kids. So, I can see how people who are maybe more used to somebody more like them, a George W. Bush, would recognize this guy is very different. You remember when Ted Cruz talked about New York values and was properly shut down by Donald Trump?
Oh, yeah.
Well, there's a little bit of that. But many evangelicals are coming around. He's not like them, but, he's not from Manhattan either. He's from Queens. He talks to Queens.
That's a huge difference.
Yeah. So
that's a huge difference.
Yeah. Well, I'm not a New Yorker, so I'm not so sensitive, but I can tell the accent's very different. And I think people are starting to get it. I would think the evangelicals will come around. Catholics, I don't know. I think he's going to make a pitch to them. But
what do you think the basic resistance among Catholic voters is going to be based upon to Donald Trump?
That's hard to say. I mean, the connection between Catholics and George W. Bush was somewhat artificial and coopered together by a couple of brilliant strategists such as yourself. With Reagan, it was more genuine, I think. The Reagan Democrats. I don't know that either Reagan or Trump had the natural feel for them. But
you would think. By the way, let me interrupt and just say, as someone who's operated a business in New York City as much as Trump has, it would seem to me he would have a natural feel for two groups, Jews and Catholics.
Totally right. Totally right.
But does he?
he's all indeed. He's been faulted with his connections to certain members of one ethnic Catholic community in New York.
Yeah. So it seems to me that he can just draw upon, a whole career of dealing with Irish Catholics and Italian Catholics. I mean, let's face it. I mean, New York is a very staunch and deeply rooted Catholic environment.
Yeah. Well, Rudy Giuliani, who's an important voice in New York politics and the Catholic, the Buddha, is someone who's on his side. Amongst evangelicals, nobody.
Well, Ralph Reed has been very supportive.
Ralph Reed, but I was thinking of Jeff Sessions in particular.
Yes, right.
And Trump's policy guy is a guy called Steve Miller, who was essentially seconded to the Trump campaign by Jeff Sessions. And nobody speaks with more authority about policy issues than Steve Miller. So, it's a work in progress, and I have no doubt that he would have an easier time connecting with Catholic voters than say Hillary. But, that raises, something else, and we're winding down. But let me mention this. The Nixon campaign in 1968, Nixon had this slogan. People forget it, but it was very effective. It was bring us together. And it seems to me that, leaving aside some kooks on the right and some hardcore leftists, it seems to me nobody is better positioned to bring all Americans together than Donald Trump and all of this. And so I'm greatly encouraged. And you know something? This is something the Democrats would be absolutely incapable of doing. Why? Because their entire policy is, their whole party is based on splitting us apart, right? Men versus women. Blacks versus whites, Hispanics versus Native Americans. The whole party is based on a coalition of people that are, who are invited to hate each other by the Democrats. If they try to do unity, the party would disappear. There'd be nothing left.
That seemed to have been the legacy of the McGovern years.
Yeah.
When they embraced the politics of. It was a combination of, it began with feminism, and then it moved on to LGBT.
Mm-hmm.
And then with the election of Barack Obama, we were supposed to have seen, a kind of a watershed in race relations, but that's only become worsened over the last 8 years.
Well, Nixon took, I think, every state but one or two. I can't remember what 72 was, but it was certainly one of the greatest landslides. It wouldn't be such a landslide this November, but remember one thing about Trump and his outrageousness, and that is that what he's doing is he's signaling how serious he is about fixing it, about how it's broken and has to be redone. And you do that not by being mild-mannered. You don't do that by being Lindsey Graham or Jeb Bush.
Well, you got to break eggs to make an omelet, as the old saying goes.
Yeah.
I want to remind our listeners that I've been talking with Professor Frank Buckley of the George Mason School of Law. His latest book, The Way Back, Restoring the Promise of America, is the one book that I would recommend be read in this year of 2016 thus far. It's the best book I've read this year. And what's so unique about it is that here you have a well-known conservative writer, jurist, talking about the state of our country in terms of its wealth inequality, the quality of education, and how social mobility, which has characterized America for so long, has now vanished. And...
Mm.
You, is there some place where people can see your writing on a regular basis? Is there some place where you're publishing?
Well, I'm a speaker at the American Spectator, so I often publish there. I write for the American Conservative as well, or you can buy my books on Amazon.
I think that's what I'll ask people to do. His other book, or his book. That we also talked about on the show, The Once and Future King, The Rise of Crown Government in America, which really is kind of a first volume of duo that is also The Way Back, Restoring the Promise of America, were both published by Encounter. And Frank Buckley, thanks again for being a guest on Church and Culture.
Neil, it's great to be on your show. Thank you so much.
I'm sure in this election season we'll have you back very soon. And to all of you who have been listening, please come back at this time and on this day next week.
If you have any comments or questions about church and culture, you can contact Deal Hudson at dhudson@avemariaradio.net. What is a man of Christ? Would you recognize one off the street? Invictus Christus is calling men to become men of Christ, challenging men to be true disciples and witnesses to the love and mercy of our Lord Jesus Christ. On Saturday, July 16th, the Eucharistic procession is being held from the Shrine of the Little Flower to St. Mary's Catholic Church through downtown Royal Oak. The event is free and for men of all ages. For event information and registration, log on to christinthestreets.eventbrite.com. That's christinthestreets.eventbrite.com.
This is Henry Root, your host for Putting On the Mind of Christ. Each week we go into the Ave Maria CD library. We pull on a talk or two to see what our Lord might have to say to us. Most of these talks are recorded at area gatherings and conferences. Most of the speakers are nationally known. The topics are varied, but they are all centered on the Lord, and they all are worth your listening time. You're back from Mass. It's not yet dinner time. Why not sit back and join us? Be fed on the Lord. Listen this and every Sunday afternoon at 3 for Putting On the Mind of Christ on 990 WDEL in the Metro Detroit area and 1440 WMAX in the Saginaw Valley. Putting On the Mind of Christ is brought to you by the Ave Maria Communications Guild.
Today's programming on 990 WDEO is made possible in part by a gift made from our day sponsor, in loving memory of Antony and Piranha Safransky, from their son Joseph, who thanks them for the gift of life and the gift of his Ukrainian Catholic faith. Today would have been their 89th wedding anniversary. May God be praised for Antony and Piranha.
Fully Alive. Reflections on the scripture readings of today's Mass with Father Pat Egan, chaplain of Ave Maria Radio.
This Sunday's readings were all about forgiveness. The psalm says, "Blessed is the one whose fault is taken away, whose sin is forgiven. Blessed the man in whose spirit there is no guile." Our response to this is in the psalm, "Lord, forgive the wrong that I have done." We all need to pray that. The prophet Nathan corrected King David, who had sinned. "Why have you spurned the Lord and done evil in his sight?" he said. "You cut down Uriah the Hittite and taken his wife as your own. Now therefore the sword shall never depart from your house, because you despise me." Then David said to Nathan, "I have sinned against the Lord." He admitted his guilt and was forgiven. St. Paul tells us we are justified and forgiven through faith. The Gospel continues that scene, Jesus visiting a Pharisee and a sinful woman brought flask of ointment in. She stood behind him weeping and bathed her feet with her tears. The Pharisee said to himself, "He really is a true prophet. You know what sort of woman this is." Then Jesus said, "Do you see this woman? When I entered, you gave me no water for my feet, yet she's bathed them with her tears. You didn't give me a kiss, but she has not ceased kissing my feet, and you